Hi, welcome back to Common Sense Care, parenting your gender-confused child with truth and love. The gender industry's one-size-fits-all answer for all people who struggle with their gender identity is affirmative care, which means pushing them toward being transgender identified. But in no other area of medicine or education or child care is there a one-size-fits-all answer that fits every person. We believe that each person is an individual and should be given the support and care that's most appropriate for him or her. So welcome back. I'm Maria Keffler.
And I'm Erin Brewer. And what are we talking about today, Maria?
Today, we're going to talk about the fallacies of the gender industry. One of the things that you and I and most people who have been dealing with this issue for a while have recognized is there are a lot of logical flaws in not just this ideology itself, but in how it's presented. So we see headlines that they don't really represent what's actually going on. We hear arguments that are quite often false dichotomies. And that's really a lot of what I think we should talk about today is what is a false dichotomy and how are those being used to propagate this idea that people can change sex?
Well, and I think one of the reasons it's important to talk about this is so that people can kind of name what's happening, because so often I hear from parents and the public who are like, somebody said this to me and I guess it makes sense. I just don't feel okay about it. And if people can start to deconstruct the logical fallacies that are happening, the way in which they're being manipulated, that then I think it's easier to understand why it is that you feel uncomfortable with what they're saying, but to also address it and to show, hey, wait a minute, they're saying trans women are women. Let's really look at that and break it down and see if it's actually true, because they're requiring us to accept this proposition, but they haven't really, I guess they kind of begged the question. They haven't shown us how it's true. They're just saying it is true because it's true, which is one of those logical fallacies. And you probably know a lot more about this than I do. I know that logic is one of those things that I wish I had studied, but these are well-known techniques that people study and people use to manipulate other people because they work. So why don't you talk a little bit about the different logical fallacies that you've seen?
Well, again, the primary one that I keep seeing used over and over and over again is false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And a false dichotomy is where two options are presented and it's said those are the only two options. There's no other options. And if you're not listening for that, when someone tells you that, we tend to kind of believe what we hear, especially when someone says it very authoritatively. And I remember I was talking with this trans rights activist in my community. We were at a school board meeting and we were talking about the bathroom issue in that, he was pushing for self-identified, you could use whichever bathroom you identify with. This has been a long ongoing issue. And so I listened to him and I said, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I get that that's a problem for kids who feel that they do not match the sex of their birth. I understand that can be uncomfortable. And I said, my fear is that boys who are not transgender identified, who are just normal boys, may use that self-identification rule or policy to go into the bathroom and peek at girls, be a peeping Tom at girls. And this transgender activist replied to me, you think trans people shouldn't exist.
Oh, wow.
And at the time, that just caught me so off guard. I was still fairly new at this. And I was just like, I didn't know what to say to that because first of all, it was a non sequitur. It didn't follow. It had absolutely nothing to do with what I just said. Yeah. But over the last few years, I've been hearing this more and more, where if I say, hey, I have a concern about this part of this transgender ideology, they'll come back with, well, you just think trans people shouldn't exist.
Right.
That's a false dichotomy.
Yeah.
The whole bathroom issue, you will often see articles that will say anti-trans bill prevents kids from using the bathroom.
Not true.
No, that's a false dichotomy. What they're saying is either trans kids, trans-identified kids get to use the bathroom they want, or they don't get to use the bathroom at all.
Right.
That's not true. The third option is that they're asked to use the bathroom that corresponds to their sex identity.
Or they're offered a gender neutral facility or a teacher's facility. There are lots of solutions. Yeah. The one that I hear that I think is the most dangerous is you can either have a trans child or a dead child. And I hear that over and over and over again. It's being used to push parents into medically transitioning. It's being used to push legislators into accepting that this is the appropriate treatment. And it's completely false. And we know it's false. I'm here as an example that it's false. I was a trans kid. I didn't transition. I'm not dead. And the thing is about those kinds of false dichotomies is all it takes is one example to show that it's not true to break down the argument. We have so many examples where that's not true. And so it's concerning to me that they keep pushing it. And I think it's because people kind of hear that and go, oh, okay. They don't know how to break it apart. And so I think one of the things that I really urge parents to do is to listen really carefully to the kind of arguments that your children are making, to the kinds of arguments the activists are making, and really deconstruct them. Because if you can understand how they're flawed, then it's going to be a lot easier for you to argue with other people, not necessarily even argue, but advocate for alternatives. Because you can say, well, you don't have to say, well, I don't want a dead child. You can say, well, actually, there's other alternatives to that. There's other things besides having a dead child, and you can offer them. And that's a lot more effective than just being emotionally blackmailed by this false dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you want a dead son or a live daughter? Do you want a dead daughter or a live son? That's a great example of a false dichotomy. But that's also an example of an emotional plea. Yeah. They're playing on parents' emotions to get them to do what the therapist, what the gender industry wants done, which is to put a kid on a path of medicalization.
Right.
And I think that's a really great strategy. Just start asking questions. When you're dealing with someone who may be hostile to your point of view, a less aggressive way of dealing with it is just asking questions about it. Like, are those the only two options? Mm-hmm.
And that's funny because I know somebody and if you start giving counter examples, then it breaks down their argument.
Yeah.
As soon as you can say, well, I know somebody who had a different trajectory than that, or I know this situation where they handled it with a third option or a fourth option or a fifth option, then it really breaks down their arguments quickly.
Yeah. Another place that we're seeing the false dichotomies is with the sports issue. Of letting people play sports according to their gender identity as opposed to according to their biological sex. And we see this in headlines all the time, and it drives me crazy. Anti-trans bill prevents trans women from playing sports.
Right.
No, it doesn't. The false dichotomy is either trans women get to play sports with women, or they don't get to play sports with women at all. Or I'm sorry, they don't get to play sports at all.
Right.
No, they are supposed to play sports with men because trans women are biological men.
Yeah. And the other place that I see that in relation to sports, which I'm seeing more and more as bills are being passed to protect women's sports, is we can either allow transgender athletes to play, or we're going to have to check their genitals. Do you really want people checking their genitals? That's what's going to happen. We're going to have all these children are going to have their genitals inspected. Do we want that? And I hear, this is what I'm hearing now. And I'm like, no, there are other options. We don't have to go around inspecting children's genitals. And so this is, they're really good. The people who are doing this, they're very smart. They're very good at figuring out arguments and they're, like you said, they tend to be emotionally laden arguments that really hit people. Because of course, when I hear examining children's genitals, I'm like, ugh, I don't want to do that. And if I think that's the only option, boy, I'm going to be against this, but that's not the only option. And so we have to keep pushing reality.
Yeah, we had that same argument. I think so many of these arguments are just coming down from whatever the top of the gender industry is, because you keep hearing the same things said everywhere. And in my school district a couple years ago, we're pushing back on transgender policies that put children and women at risk. And those were the two things that my organization kept focusing on, was parents' rights and kids' protections. And that was all we talked about. And I had this woman in our district who is part of the Gender Identity Allies group, who started saying, Maria Kefler is obsessed with children's genitals.
Right.
And I kind of had to laugh about that. I'm like, you're the one that's transing two of your kids.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about parents' rights and kids' protection.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting one, because I hear that a lot, that people who don't support trans rights are just worried about genitals. And yet they're the ones who are seemingly to talk about genitals all the time. They're talking about genuses and girl dicks. And I mean, these are very explicitly talking about genitals. It's a way of framing an argument in a way that is gaslighting, so that people, oftentimes it makes sense. You know, when you first hear it, you're like, yeah, it kind of intuitively makes sense or emotionally makes sense, until you start deconstructing the argument. And you're like, no, we're not. This is not about children's genitals.
Not at all. And we know that that's a technique that abusers use.
Right.
That's called projection, where the abuser tells you that you're the one who's doing the thing that he or she is doing. Right. Maria Kefler is obsessed with children's genitals. No, actually, you guys are, and you're projecting that on me. We've talked about this a little bit before. I didn't intend to get here today, but about DARVO, D-A-R-V-O, which is an abuser acronym. It's deny, attack, and reverse victim and oppressor.
Which is, when I heard that, the first time I heard that, I was like, wow, I had never heard that term before. And it just totally made sense, because I keep thinking, how is it that people are feeling so sorry for these trans activists when they have so much money, so much power, so much influence? They're clearly not oppressed. I don't understand. They're the ones that are bullying us. And then somebody explained DARVO to me, and I was like, this is a technique.
Deny it. No, we don't have money. Mm-hmm. No, we don't have power. They deny all that. Then they attack. Mm-hmm. You're a TERF, you're a hater, you're a bigot, you're a phobe. And then they reverse victim and oppressor. Yeah. We are not the oppressors, we are the victims. You're the one oppressing us because you won't let us into your bathrooms. You're oppressing us because you won't let us have sex with lesbians and call ourselves lesbians.
You won't let us medicalize your children. You don't want us to retard your children's development. You guys are such bullies. It really is exactly what's happening. So I think, and again, these are all so emotional. And I think part of the problem is, again, the way the press is presenting this, that they've been so disingenuous. And I really encourage parents to be aware of that, because it's such an influence. And even if your kids haven't been kind of indoctrinated into this ideology, to talk with them about it. This is something that my parents used to do all the time with my brother and I. They very much liked arguments. And I'm not sure that I would encourage arguments, but one thing that they would do is they would have us watch TV and then deconstruct the commercials about how come they were wrong. Or to read a headline, like at the dinner table, maybe, you know, my stepfather or my mother would read a headline, and my brother and I would have to basically compete to see who could deconstruct it better. And this is just something they enjoyed doing, because that's just, you know, that was how they got their entertainment, I guess. But it taught me some really good skills, and it got me, I'm so critical as a result of it, maybe too critical, but I very quickly can hone in and see, like, wait a minute, you know, where is that coming from? Which is probably why when I got the Equality Utah letter talking about conversion therapy, I think most people would have read through it and been like, yeah, of course we want to ban this kind of horrible therapy on children. But, you know, I was in my deconstruct mode, and I'm like, conversion therapy, what's that? Wait, what are they saying? What are they doing? And that was how I first got got involved in this is because I realized they were trying to block the very therapy that helped me as a kid. And I'm thankful that I have those skills. Otherwise, I might be donating to Equality Utah right now to help them fight conversion therapy, which is exactly what they want.
Right, right. Well, I think that's really one of the most important things you can do. And I love that you brought up that example of what your parents used to do with you guys, because one of the very most basic things you can do when you're deconstructing something, I think, is to ask, what are the definitions here? Yeah. What do these words mean?
Because are they agreed upon?
Yeah. And are they agreed upon? Because quite often we are talking about very different things. Mm-hmm. Most people, I believe, most people in the culture, when they hear conversion therapy, they're thinking electric shock treatment. They're thinking aversion techniques. They're thinking ice cold water baths. And
even reparative rape, which I've heard people talk about as part of conversion therapy. And of course we don't want, oh my gosh.
But that is not what conversion therapy means to the trans activists and to trans, the gender industry. To them, conversion therapy is defined as anything other than affirmation. So that means anything other than telling a child, yes, you absolutely are transgender.
Right.
And I mean anything else.
Yeah, even a parent who's like questioning, not wanting to use the pronouns is now considered conversion therapy among the activists. The UN is actually trying to push an agenda where they're trying to criminalize conversion therapy. And that would be parents, that would be pastors, that would be crosswalk guards, that would be doctors. Anybody who interacts with a child who doesn't affirm them.
That's actually another false dichotomy, mm-hmm. because the false dichotomy is you either affirm the transgender identity, tell that child, yes, you absolutely are transgender and we need to medicalize you, or you're an abuser.
Right.
That's the false dichotomy that they've set up. So when you hear a parent is unsupportive, a parent is toxic, a parent is bigoted, what they are really saying is that parent has rejected the affirmation only plan. That parent is saying, no, I don't think every child should be put on a path to medicalization. That's the definition,
right,
of affirmation vice abuse. That's the false dichotomy there.
And it's amazing just thinking about that, the definitions, how quickly they've been able to kind of appropriate definitions. You know, they now sort of freely refer to biological women as cisgender if they don't claim a transgender identity, which is incredibly offensive to me and to a lot of women who are like, what does it mean to identify as a woman? Like, what does that even mean? They're putting labels on us. And this is a term now that has pretty much been accepted in society. I see all the time grown people referring to themselves as cisgender. And I'm like, wow, you're just buying into that. Like, do you even know what that means? Do you even understand what that label is doing to you? You know, for me, as someone who had gender dysphoria as a child, it's very offensive. For detransitioners, it's very offensive. For most women who have struggled with feeling comfortable as a woman most of their lives, it's very offensive. And yet it's a terminology that's sort of just been injected into our society and accepted. Probably because most people don't even know what's going on.
Right. They've been told that's nice. That's fine to use that. But what an interesting, I hadn't thought about this until you were talking about it. What an interesting sort of false dichotomy that actually breaks down the transgender ideology logic, because, you're either transgender or you're cisgender. But wait a minute. I thought gender was on a continuum.
Yeah.
And you could be anywhere from G.I. Joe to Barbie doll. Mm-hmm. So if it's a continuum, how is there a dichotomy?
It's also fluid.
Right. So what does it even mean?
Yeah.
Where is the line between transgender and cisgender?
Right. If I sort of sometimes don't feel like a woman, am I cisgender? And can I be fluid between being transgender and cisgender? Can I be both? Can I be neither?
To clarify, we're talking about personality.
Yeah.
We're just talking about personality, and personality can be anything you would like it to be on any day that you would like to be. But the actual dichotomy is there's men, there's women. That's the real dichotomy. There's you know, there's nothing else.
Right. Yeah. And it's so interesting to me because these rely on regressive gender stereotypes. So basically this very progressive movement, which claims to be, you know, moving us forward, is actually hurling us backwards, because they're basically saying that gender is defined by these regressive gender stereotypes, and your sex is actually influenced by whether or not you ascribe to them, which is quite shocking, really, that your sex changes based on your personality or based on your behavior at the time. So in theory, my sex can change when I'm struggling with gender dysphoric feelings. That would be pretty nonsensical when you break it down.
So when I got a flat tire, I didn't get a flat tire. I got a low tire light on my car while I was out driving. And I'm not an auto kind of person at all, but I was like, I'm on my own. My husband's at work. I got to take care of this. I went to the gas station and I got the air and I filled out my own tire, and I was feeling really butch. Like,
oh, you must have been in male mode.
Was I a man that day? No, I was a woman. I was a woman the whole time I was doing that. Yeah. I can fill my car tires with air and I'm still 100% a woman while I'm doing it.
Right. Yeah. And that's where it's incredibly frustrating. And I think, you know, this whole ideology is based on a house of cards. You know, there isn't really a firm foundation to it. None of it makes sense. And so, they have to keep, responding with these logical fallacies because there really isn't a foundation upon which they can build this. And so in some ways it almost seems like you can just, like, you know, blow on it and it's all going to fall over. In people who are thinking rationally, that's how it feels. But when you're kind of in it, and that's something that this is where it's important to remember that this moves into sort of a belief system. It's not based on logic. They're trying to push it based on logical fallacies, but underlying those, you know, that is a belief system, is what, you know, is something, a cult or, a religious belief system based on the concept that your soul is gendered and can be born into the wrong body. And so that's part of the problem, is that they're trying to argue logic with something that's a worldview or a belief system. And unless somebody assumes your same belief system, then none of this is going to make any sense to them.
Yeah. I think we have a video clip from John Corvino talking about false dichotomies. And I thought he really explains it really well.
He did an excellent job. And I just want to encourage people to go to his website, because if you want to, like, short lessons in all these different kinds of logical fallacies, he talks about slippery slope. He talks about begging the question. He talks about all these different ways in which people can use what seems like logic to forward their perspective, but actually, if you know what they're doing, you know, red herrings, straw men, if you can identify, oh, I know what that is, then you can, first of all, you can understand why you're feeling like, wait a minute, this doesn't really make sense, and you can address it. So let's watch that video.
Suppose we walk into an ice cream shop and they're out of vanilla. And you say, well, I guess you're going to have chocolate then. Well, actually, no. What if there are other flavors? What about strawberry or butter pecan or boom chocolate cookie core? It's an actual flavor. The problem is you've leapt to a conclusion while ignoring key alternatives. That's the fallacy of false dilemma. You're saying A or B, not A, therefore B, while forgetting about C and D and so on. What a false dilemma does is to oversimplify in a way that renders the argument unsound. Now, you might object at this point, yeah, but couldn't there also be a false trilemma or a false quadrilemma? Actually, I'd agree with you. The problem is the same. By forcing a conclusion while leaving key options off the table, these arguments commit some version of the fallacy of false dilemma.
Oh, that was such a good video. I love the way he presents these things.
Yeah, and it's just so quick and so simple and so clear. And you just go, oh, well, right.
And it's something, I think we have not been taught to think this way. Mm-hmm. I know in the schools are not teaching critical thinking skills anymore. And that's really what looking at fallacies is. It's learning to look at things critically, or like your parents taught you. Mm-hmm. Listen to something, look at something, take apart what it really means, what it's really trying to say. And we just haven't been taught that. And kids haven't been taught that. I've been married for over 21 years. And we have had some arguments in my marriage over the years. My husband loves to argue. He's one of five kids, and it's recreational for him. Like, he gets a charge out of debating and arguing.
Yeah, that's how my parents were. Yeah, it was like entertainment.
And I grew up mostly alone. My only brother's 12 years older than I am, so he was more like an uncle than a brother. So I didn't have that sort of iron sharpening iron kind of experience. So about 10 or 12 years into our marriage, I remember the moment going, I'm so tired of this. I'm so tired of losing fights. If he wants to fight, I'm going to learn how to fight. And I think I actually got Logic for Dummies or Argument for Dummies or something like that. And I started learning how to argue, because I'd be having an argument with him and he would back me into a corner, and I'd have that feeling like, I know something's wrong with this. I know this is not a good argument, but I didn't know how to take it apart. And just in time, over practicing, and I don't want to make my husband sound like a bully. He's not a bully. He just loves debating. Yeah. But as I've practiced and as I've learned how to think critically, how to think on my feet, how to ask those questions, I can hold my own much better. And the debates are actually a little bit more fun now than they used to be. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'll ever consider arguing recreational, but there is a skill to being able to do it. And I think it's a skill we all need to have.
I do too. And the other thing that kind of engagement does is that you have to be listening to someone in order to identify, you know, where the flaws in their arguments are. And that's something that I don't think we're doing a very good job of either, is listening. And if somebody's talking to you and you're just constantly trying to interrupt and trying to interject, they're not going to feel very heard. So even if you have someone who you completely disagree with, if you're able to let them present their argument and listen, really listen to it, and then kind of counter it with a question, that's going to feel so much more respectful than just rolling your eyes at someone or saying, well, that's stupid, or that doesn't make any sense. And so in a way, it's a way to engage with the opposition in a way that might actually help them come along. Because first of all, it's really hard to call someone names when you know that they've been listening to you. Yeah. If that happens, it's really clear that the other person is the one who's on the offensive. And so I think that is, you know, respectfully listening is something that this kind of engagement can really produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we have one question that this actually came out of a seminar that I was not present at, but a friend of mine was present. And she talked about, the seminar was about transgender ideology. The presenter was talking about all of the logic and illogic involved with it. But she said during the Q&A time after, it was a lot of young people. I think it was a lot of high school and college students. And my friend said the question that she kept hearing from all these people present, these kids, was, how do we address this topic with friends and teachers? Where do we begin to get people to think critically about this? Like, how do we have those conversations?
That is such a good question. And again, I think part of the way you get there is listening. You start out by being willing to listen. And there's actually a book by Peter Boghossian, and I can't remember the name of it, but he actually talks about, you know, how to engage with people. And the first thing that you need to do is develop a rapport with them. So before you try to change someone's mind, you need to develop, even if it's just a pretty superficial relationship, but some kind of relationship. Otherwise, they have no desire to listen to you. So letting them know that you're sort of committed to the relationship. So, you know, ask them about themselves, find out about themselves, you know, find out, you know, build that rapport first. And then those questions, those critical questions, that way the person doesn't feel attacked. And it requires them a lot of times. You know, I've seen this with my kids. I've even seen it with myself, where it's easier to admit changing your mind. It's easier to admit you're wrong when you're the one who comes to that conclusion than when someone is like, you're wrong. Yeah. And so if you can kind of gently guide someone to that, it's going to be so much easier for them to admit that they were wrong than you just sort of, you know, putting it right in their face and showing them how they're wrong.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think those questions are so important because they are not aggressive. If you can ask a question calmly, mm-hmm. really with concern and a genuine sense of, I want to understand, you know, I want to understand where you're coming from. I want to understand what you think about this. Mm-hmm. And even I've heard you suggest this, Erin, just say like, I really don't get it. This is something I don't get. Can you help me understand this part of it?
Yeah, this just, I'm stuck here. You know, just, and because then they feel like you're trying, you're working on it. And I really feel like in this particular ideology, it's on such shaky ground that it doesn't take much to blow that house of cards over. And so it's not like we have to aggressively, you know, prove they're wrong. We just have to get them to the point where they start questioning, because once they do, it's like, oh, yeah. You know, all they have to do is start finding that one example where, you know, A and B wasn't what happened. There's actually C, D, E, F, and G. And as detransitioners are starting to speak out, as the medical evidence is mounting about the dangers of medicalization, it's so easy to find those counterexamples now. All you have to do is say, so have you heard about the Kira Bell case? You know, that's some a way to open it up. And if they haven't, then that gives you an opportunity to say, well, it's interesting. In this case, the high court actually found there wasn't evidence to support these interventions and that they're experimental. Isn't that interesting? And again, that's not confrontational. It's just a way of sort of starting a conversation and discussing it.
With this issue, really the only way to continue to believe that these things are true is to not entertain mm-hmm. any questions, right. is to not let yourself listen to questions, to keep yourself from hearing dissenting voices. And that's really what the industry is trying to do. It's trying to keep people from being able to ask those questions. It's what's happening in the media with the false dichotomies in the headlines. That's the only way to propagate this, to continue the lie, is to silence the truth. Because you're right, the truth is really overwhelming.
Yeah. And again, anytime you've got an ideology that's based on belief systems and they're trying to present it as logical and factual, it's pretty easy to break it down. But it's that connection. You really have to build some kind of a rapport with the person before you can start to sort of plant those seeds of questioning. But once you do, it there really isn't much for this ideology to stand on. So again, arm yourself, I think, with these ways to break down arguments. Go to, you know, I would suggest watching some of, tell me his name again, John?
John Corvino.
Yeah, watch some of these videos and practice. I think it's really good. I know, Maria, you don't like doing this. But if you can find someone who you can practice, you know, have somebody engage in an argument with you for practice so that you can start seeing these techniques, so you start naming, okay, oh, I know what she did there. That's this. I know how to address that. I have to, you know, do this. It will really help you when you're under stress, because a lot of times it's hard to think clearly when you're being bombarded with information or when you've got a trans activist yelling in your face or an angry kid. And that's probably not the time to engage in an argument anyway, but at least you can sort of name what they're doing, and that will help you sort of feel settled in, okay, I know what I'm dealing with here.
Well, in today's culture, there's a wealth of opportunity to practice these skills. Get on Facebook, read two or three posts, and ask yourself, what are the definitions here? Where's that person coming from? Am I seeing some false dichotomies? Am I seeing some straw men? Am I seeing some ad hominem?
Yeah.
When you start researching these and start learning them, you watch a few Don Corvino videos and then go to Facebook, go to Instagram, go to, you know.
You see it everywhere.
You will see them all over the place, and you'll probably be terrified for the future of humanity. And I'm so sorry that we've done that to you.
Yeah, but the other thing is, I notice I do them too. I mean, I think we settle into these because they're easy. You know, they're easy. They're sort of a lazy way to make an argument. And when you're with somebody who agrees with you, it's really easy to sort of, you know, put these out there and have them go, yeah, yeah. And so unfortunately, like you said, they're not teaching these critical thinking skills in the schools anymore. And I think
not the public schools.
No, I think it's a huge disservice. So parents, maybe arm your kids with this, with these skills too. Get them maybe not debating, but just to understand how these different arguments can be used. A lot of kids, once they learn about this, they're like, ooh.
Yeah, it's a great book. And we should put it in the resources. There's a great book called The Fallacy Detective. Mm-hmm. It's for kids, but it's great for anybody who wants to learn about these. It's a very small book, just sort of a handbook. I think it's got like 38 short lessons, 2-3 pages each, on identifying logical fallacies and combating them. Two of my kids have had that assigned to them in some of their homeschool programs. And I think it's a really great resource for starting to think critically. So The Fallacy Detective.
Okay, we'll include that in the resources below.
Great.
And what are we talking about next week?
Next week, we're going to talk about why parents affirm. Mm. And this might seem like a throwaway, like, oh, why are we spending a whole episode talking about that? But the more we talk to parents, the more we learn what they're suffering, what they're dealing with. Honestly, it's actually easier in the short term to affirm than it is to not.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of reasons.
When dealing with teenagers.
Yeah.
And we'll address sort of some of the people who are advocating in this, who are starting to affirm children who are really young, and why they might be doing it as well. There's lots of different motivations. So I think that'll be an interesting topic next week.
Yep. I'm looking forward to it. Well, thanks so much, Erin. It's always good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, Maria. Thank you.
See you next time. Bye. We are not doctors or therapists. We are not giving medical or psychiatric advice, and we offer no guarantee of outcomes. We simply want to talk about how to support and love kids using long understood best practices from the fields of psychology, education, and child development. We're glad you joined in our conversation today, and we hope that you took away something you can put in your toolkit for parenting your gender-confused